So would each of you tell me one thing that if it were in your power to change, you would change about the way we select our candidates for office in America?
Well, this is unconstitutional. That's the problem. And I also recognize that 40 years ago, I thought the problem was the other way. But one of the things that has contributed to this nationalization of American politics, where one Republican from Ohio is the same as a Republican from Oregon, a Democrat from New Jersey is the same as one from New Mexico, is the nationalization of funding. That, you know, basically a whole lot of Republican money comes out of Texas, a whole lot of Democratic money comes out of Hollywood and New York. And the donors can impose a national agenda on candidates for vastly different reasons. So if you had basically like a provision that said you can only take money from people who reside in your district, whatever it is, your state, your district, then a Colorado Republican would be different from a Texas or South Carolina Republican, and the same for Democrats.
That's a great idea, and I second that. And I think that would be a very successful way to do it. I have an even more unusual idea, which is, some people are going to hate, but I would return more power over party nominations to institutional political parties. What happens right now is you have a small group, sometimes we're talking single digits in a district, who vote in primaries and select the nominees. And oftentimes the institutional party is kind of embarrassed by who gets nominated. If you'll remember in 2010, the Republicans lost a Senate seat that should have been theirs because they nominated a woman who called herself a witch and then had to deny being a witch. There's a lot of weird stuff that happens in primaries. Mm-hmm. And I think that, and whereas political parties have an ongoing institutional interest in winning elections. That's why they exist. And I think it would be helpful, and I've got a piece coming out in the New York University Law Review about this in presidential politics, if we returned some more control to institutional political parties. By the way, that's the way it used to be for most of American history, and we didn't do so bad.
Yeah. I'm quoting here, I think, Elaine, have you not said in the past a list of illustrious presidents who were nominated essentially by superdelegates?
Oh, all of them. Roosevelt, Eisenhower, okay. There's this big brouhaha about superdelegates. And literally until 1972, both political parties had nothing to do with primaries. Okay, the presidential primaries that existed in the 50s were not beauty contests, they were not primaries that elected delegates. They were beauty contests. They were roundly ignored by everybody in the political system, and the decisions were made by party people at conventions. So if you go back and look at the presidents nominated that we all now love, they were nominated by Republicans and Democrats in that way.
What is the role of third parties in our current political environment? A real alternative or as spoilers? Mel?
Well, often they are spoilers, but I think if you look historically, what third parties have done in American democracy is they have pushed one or the other party in a certain direction. And so most of the time what happens to a third party is it kind of gets eaten up by one of the major political parties. There's still some spoilers, but you know, for instance, there's not an awful lot of difference between the platform of the Democratic Party and the Green Party. Now, they still exist. They have been spoilers in some instances. But the fact of the matter is that if you want the environmental party these days, it's the Democratic Party, for better or for worse, right, depending on your politics. So the third parties do tend to push the parties, and they do tend to push them in the direction of certain issues, but they don't, other than sometimes when it's very close, they're not going to become major parties.
Mo, what's your thought on this?
I agree with all of that. The only thing I'd add is that I think the time has never been riper. The time has never been, there been a more need for a third party. And I'd really like to see the third party totally crash the party system. I mean, I agree, they tend to be spoilers, they tend to be picked in by the other parties, but the Republicans in the 1850s destroyed the Whigs and Know-Nothings and others who were around at the time. And I just think we have a system that simply doesn't fit the 21st century. It's a system that was born in the 60s and developed in the 80s. And man, do we need sort of a different alignment. And so out of the ashes, I'd hope some more sensible coalitions would emerge.
Can I say a moment on that? Say one thing on that. The problem with doing that, because I know some friends of mine have written books to this effect, et cetera, is that the Democratic and Republican parties are very handy clues to what you believe, right? If you believe, going back to your data, if you believe in choice for women, then you're going to be a Democrat. If you think abortion is really, really bad, then you're going to be a Republican. And you don't have to spend a lot of time away from your normal life. You don't have to spend a lot of time sort of figuring out what the positions are. We Americans, even though they don't read the newspapers, et cetera, they got a general sense of what the Democrats are, what the Republicans are. Now, the problem with breaking that up is no one knows what independents are. Nobody knows. How do independents stand on size of government? How do independents stand on fracking? How do independents stand on abortion or on health care for all? Nobody knows what that is. So to have a third party, to really break up the party, you would need actually something that had a coherent set of ideas, and you'd have to work really hard at it year after year, and nobody's done it.
I agree with the argument that parties clarify choices for the voters. I'd have more sympathy for it if there were more than two of them. If there were four or five clear parties, but as they say, we're being forced into these two choices, which I, for one, simply never am happy with, what I rarely am happy with when I go out there.
Several of you have asked about the tone of political discourse in our country today. One question is, given the alarming tone political discourse has taken, what do either of you suggest to counteract it? A number of people have also talked about gatherings of friends and family and how difficult it is to talk about anything in the public sphere. Anything you could suggest to counteract the current state of our political discourse?
Well, I'd say everybody should quit watching CNN and cable TV for a start, and realize that this is simply not representative of people out there. But I think people don't, there's not enough interaction anymore. I mean, I apologize for saying this, but I always tell our graduate students, don't listen to NPR, listen to AM channels. You know, you got to sort of listen to what's out there, listen to Howard Stern, listen to all these other channels out there, because you're not sort of getting the pulse of America in the kind of outlets people tend to listen to. But I mean, the breakdown in civility is not just in politics, it sort of permeates our system, and I don't think, I don't know what we can really do about that. Fortunately, most people in their real lives don't behave like that.
I do think that the internet has contributed to the breakdown in civility just because of the anonymity of it. I mean, when I publish things in the broader press, I get the most awful, awful emails, just rude and mean and very sexist. And, I know that most of the time these people wouldn't right. say that to right. me face to face. But I think they feel free to do that. And look, let's face it, Donald Trump alone is responsible for this. There is no other person who's ever, he behaves badly.
I'm going to paraphrase one of these questions to segue from this consideration. Would there be a benefit in shortening the amount of time that we spend choosing particularly presidential candidates?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure how you could do that. The way they do that in other countries is that they have free television for the candidates. And the free TV starts like 6 weeks in front of the election. So there's lots of jockeying around behind the scenes, et cetera, but then there's a start date. The political parties get a certain amount of time, usually based on the proportion of their last vote. And then every night, everybody's subjected to this for a period of time, and then they have an election, and it's over. It's not a bad idea, but I can't see us doing it, okay? And given that, I don't know how we would do it.
The professor you mentioned earlier, who influenced both of us, actually defended the system. And his argument was it forced the presidential candidates to get out to every little nook and cranny of the United States and see what this country looked like. Otherwise, I may never get out of Washington. You know, I mean, I think there are arguments on both sides, in other words. Mm-hmm.
Here's a question for you, Mo. Great summary of poll data, the questioner says, and I certainly agree. But after 2016, can people really trust polls? Are polls the good source of data that all of us in political science assume or need to feel that they are?
Yeah, it's actually a misconception. The polls were very good in 2016. The national polls actually were better in 2016 than 2012. What happened was state polls. There were a number of states that were extremely close that they missed those. In some cases, they simply didn't poll right up to election day. And the other problem for political polling is simply we don't have good turnout models. That, you know, it's just really hard to predict turnout. And so if white working class people come out and turn out 5% higher than they're predicted to by traditional models in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, your poll is off. And what really was off was the kind of models that the New York Times and Vox and 528 used, where they said 99% certain. There's nothing in politics that's 99% certain. That's just crazy. You know, and they had sort of built these elaborate models which were based on false assumptions. But the actual national polls, despite the fact it's getting harder and harder to reach people and cell phones and everything, they still continue to do a pretty good job. And the internet polls are gradually taking over. And they're doing a pretty decent job too.
Better than many people may realize because of some of the factors that you're talking about. And I do understand that. Here's a practical one. Do you think the Electoral College will ever be eliminated? And I realize there are problems with that. Will we go to a popular vote ever?
Will we what?
Go to a popular vote.
Well, there are ways. The big problem, of course, with eliminating the Electoral College is it's in the Constitution. So you need a constitutional amendment, which is really a problem. So we don't want to go there. But there are other ways of fixing the Electoral College without a constitutional amendment. The Constitution does not say that electoral votes have to be awarded to a presidential candidate based upon a winner-take-all system. That's simply tradition. Sometimes it's in state law, but it is not in the Constitution. So in Maine, for instance, there's two congressional districts. The two votes that are the senators go to the winner of the state, and then if you win the first congressional district, it goes to one candidate. If a different candidate wins the second congressional district, goes to them. Now you can see that if a system like that was adopted by all 50 states simultaneously, that actually would probably come a little bit closer to reflecting the national vote. The problem is that it has to be, as Bell and I were talking in the swimming pool this afternoon, it's a collective action problem, okay? If Texas decides to stay winner take all and California decides to award congressional districts, well, that hurts the Democrats, right? Because there's always a couple districts in California that go Republican, hard as it is to imagine. Texas always has a couple districts that go Democratic, but they wouldn't get them. So everybody would have to do that at the same time. And of course, election administration, election decisions, there's a kind of bias in constitutional law towards state action, not federal action. So basically, it is a problem, but a lot of people are thinking about it. A lot of people, because we have had, in our lifetime, we've had two elections where the one candidate won the popular vote and didn't win the Electoral College vote. So this is now, I think, more of an issue than it ever has been.
Yeah, the same problem arises even more seriously in these proposals for the Interstate Compact to agree to give your electoral votes to the popular vote winner. As soon as, say, Trump wins re-election and these tell California you have to vote your electoral votes for Trump, the
yeah.
compact is off.
Right.
Yeah, and so, yeah. so you can't enforce it, yeah.
And we should also say that by congressional districts, if you award the electoral votes by congressional districts, it does not change the result of the 2016 election. It might change some of our votes in the past, but generally speaking, not the way that the people who proposed this had in mind. There are several questions that deal either with special interest groups or groups with a great deal of money, Citizens United decision. What are your thoughts about trying to, in some sense or another, restrain the influence of big, big money in our politics?
I think many political scientists think the role of money is exaggerated. There is so much money, both sides have so much, that the idea that your vote goes up or down in perfect linear correlation with money, I think it's just an exaggeration. I just don't worry about it. Among the things I worry about, that's not at the top of the list.
Yeah, political scientists are not particularly concerned about that. There are transparency issues, which I think mm-hmm. are important, and I think we could do a lot better on looking and getting sources of money in real time. See, there's just no reason why in this day and age we have to wait for quarterly reports from the Federal Election Commission to see who's giving to somebody. We ought to have a federal law that is real-time reporting. But, you know, I've worked in a lot of presidential campaigns, and I'll tell you, it's like that kid's toy where they hit something down with a hammer and something else pops up.
Whack-a-mole.
Yeah, you suppress money here, comes up somewhere else. I mean, that, and believe me, I've been part of figuring out how to get it to come up someplace else. So, I mean, I just, and I'm not that smart. There's a lot smarter people out there. So I think it will always happen, but we ought to know more about it than we do.
Dave Barry, whom I quoted earlier, his proposal is they should be like, politicians should be like NASCAR drivers. They should wear sashes and it says NRA, you know, and Bloomberg, you know, and just sort of everybody should have it on. So transparency is the key, you know, just sort of like that.
Well, apart from that marvelous idea, one of our questioners wants to know, how can we get more younger people involved in politics?
Well, they're doing a pretty good job. I mean, I think we have a millennial generation that is more active than we've seen previous generations be. In spite of all the independents out there, and millennials love to call themselves independents to pollsters, they are a very democratic generation. They gave their votes in very large numbers to Obama twice. In the special elections we've seen, there's a big age difference. The charts I showed you on Trump's approval rating have a big age difference. I think this is a pretty unique and pretty different generation. Again, because it has more people of color in it than any previous generation in American history, sometimes you see this when sometimes the pollsters break it out by age, sometimes they break it out by race. So you see it in both times, but the fact is that they're overlapping because people of color in the United States, whether Latino or African American, also tend to be younger than the general population. So that's the confluence there. And, you know, a lot of people think it's uncool to call yourself a Democrat or Republican, but let me tell you, when they vote, they are voting for Democrats, and they are pretty unhappy with what's going on. So I think they're pretty active.
What about the West Coast view?
There's some research, Russell Dalton's the leading figure here, that shows that younger people are actually quite active, not politically, but socially. That they sort of have given up, especially on electoral politics. And granted, if you look at the last 10, 15 years, you can see reasons why. But they are involved in community things. They're involved in sort of social as opposed to purely national political type electoral politics things. So I think given the right stimulus, I think they'd be brought back. Yeah.
I don't know if we can deal with these two questions, related questions, in the limited time that we have, but if you could possibly struggle to formulate a very succinct answer, what do you see as the basis of the animosity towards Nancy Pelosi?
Look, they need a scapegoat. I mean, Hillary Clinton isn't around, so Nancy Pelosi is. You can't tell me that there wasn't a heavy dose of misogyny and sexism in the last election. There was. And by the way, it was coming not just from the Republicans, it was coming from the Bernie bros, who were quite obnoxious towards Clinton herself. So there was a lot of that. I think she's replaced Hillary as the bad person. She's also, let's face it, very liberal. She's from San Francisco. Yeah. She's part of those elites that Mo had in his chart. She also happens to be one of the most savvy inside players that we've ever had in the United States Congress. So just let me just say, and parenthetically, not for quotes in this public thing, if we're going to impeach a president next year, I want Nancy Pelosi guiding it through the Congress. Yeah. I don't want some new person who doesn't even know of the first thing about parliamentary rules. I want Nancy Pelosi.
Mo?
I actually disagree somewhat here. That I think simply the fact that you're a rich San Francisco Democrat who goes out sort of pontificating about all these liberal values is sort of enough of an explanation. And you know, we really looked for misogyny in the last election, and frankly, you can't find much of it. But my Jennifer Lawless, the women's studies head of women's studies at American University, has this wonderful comment. She said, "I think it was more Clintonism than sexism," and the idea that Clinton has been out there 20, 30 years, there's a lot of baggage out there. And I just think sexism is something that comes in at the end. There's plenty of sort of more obvious kinds of things, like your political positions, that explain a lot of it.
Before we wrap up, I cannot let you get away without asking you to violate that famous presidential admonition from President Eisenhower that it was very difficult to make predictions, especially about the future. You've already commented on this, Mo, and I'm going to put you on the spot nonetheless. What do you expect to have happen in November? And a little codicil, do you think the Mueller investigation will affect the November elections?
No. I think the vast bulk of the American population is paying absolutely no attention to it. And this is just something that the 1% is occupying them. And I listen to CNN in the airports as I go through, and I just think, God, who's listening to these people? And there's actually a good book that's out there about how changes in the technology and changes in that made it profitable to have these niche audiences. The big thing is simply that in the old days of broadcasting, you might only reach 1 out of 100 viewers with your product. But now that you can, the audience of these shows are very, very specific and so identifiable. And so the advertisers can figure out exactly what these people want. And so it's become, a million viewers is really enough to keep all these shows on them. And so it just doesn't represent what people are thinking in general. It just represents what certain advertisers are willing to pay for.
Did I miss your scoreboard?
What?
Did I miss your judgment?
I said the day after the 2016 election, I said I think it's likely the Democrats will take the House simply based on historical midterm losses and the 24 seats is well within. And I still think that's, for me, it's about 50-50. You know, there's things going back and forth. The economy is doing real well, but Trump's numbers aren't good. And normally those two things go together. If the economy is doing well, the president's approval ratings are high. And so Trump is really an anomaly here. And so the statistical models we use don't really sort of fit in this situation. And so, I think probably it's 50-50.
Elaine, I'll give you the last word.
I think Democrats will take the House. The question is really how many. Is it a, you know, do they get 30, pick up 30 seats and take control, or is it a 40 to 60 seat swing, which is a big swing? They've done a good job of recruiting candidates. They've done a good job of trying to, they've got a lot of veterans running. They've got a lot of businessmen running. They've got a lot of women running. They've done a good job of getting, by and large, the best candidates in the districts, and we often forget about that when we talk nationally, that it does matter that you have a decent and realistic candidate running. I think the Mueller investigation per se doesn't affect, but I think that it does have an effect. This president has been under a cloud for 2 years. It is an ethical cloud that is quite serious. And people may not know the details, they may not know what the Rick Gates testified in the Manafort trial, et cetera, but they know there's something out there that doesn't smell right. And I think that's why Trump has low approval numbers, even though the economy is so good. And I think it will affect at least decisions about the Congress, because people are, let's face it, they're a little queasy about this president. And I think, so it's not a direct effect, but I think it creates a sense of doubt about the man who's president.
Thank you. Thank you both.